writer, she's an activist, and her brand new book, what could be better than this title, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Oh my God, we could go all day
on this. We could go all day on this.
Sarai, we could just like open up our mouths and let the bees fly out and we're ready to go. But I want to start. You say very early on in this book that the consequences of anger are different for women.
Right.
And they are especially different for women of color.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that brings to mind any recent events for you that you might just immediately
comes to mind, right?
Your brain, and you could think, can I think of an example of
a glaring example of a
woman of color and her anger being singled out in a distinct way?
Right. So, this morning's update on the weekend's Serena Williams outraged display at the U.S. Open, quite stunningly, is that a group of umpires is saying that they won't officiate at her games, which is really amazing if you consider the long history of men's overt displays of anger and emotionality and obscenity and, you know, a whole range of behaviors, including racket damage. The fact that a group of refs would get together and say, you know, we're just not going to do that. All I could really think of, honestly, was the notion of boys picking up their toys and leaving.
Right.
Like, we just won't take this. We're not going to take this from this person. And I don't know that it's precedented. I don't, you know, maybe someone can tell me later, as I'm sure someone will. But this is a remarkable position to take. It's a body of people, overwhelmingly men, basically saying this woman's behavior is just unacceptable to us.
Right, and this is not just any woman.
That's
either.
Right.
It's not just some up-and-comer who maybe we need to teach a lesson
mm-hmm.
to. This is the greatest living
athlete
in the world.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's pertinent. I mean, many of the men who play on the circuit have come forward to say, you know, I've done far worse and I haven't been penalized. And you may not agree with the way she chose to express herself, but it's clear that the penalties that have accrued to her are just different. I mean, she's been levied the highest penalty for verbal abuse in the U.S. Open. And, you know, there are videotapes, compilations of men behaving badly, zipping around, and you think, how is that possible? How could it be that this is the result of what she said?
Where the men's behavior is seen as part of their charisma.
That's exactly right. I saw an article earlier today that basically was a ranking of tennis's bad boys. We don't do that with women, you know. It's just that we really do expect them, particularly if you're a strong black woman, to control themselves, to always be in control, to not push, not offend, and not display the emotionality that is really rational in that context. I mean, it's a big game. It's an important match. And I laugh because I think it was John McEnroe years ago, of course he was famous for this, he said, we can't play by those rules that expect us to just be quiet and genteel. And here we are with this situation.
And as you point out in the book, when women are successful in a particular industry, you talk about the way that women in sports are talked about and
yes.
the adjectives that are used to describe
very different.
Them. And the way that women in economics are talked
yes.
about and what keywords come up.
Oh.
And they are not... they're not about their skills and education and talent and abilities
right.
and accolades.
None of that. I mean, they're really old school gendered slurs. I mean, they never end. And I think the thing that you're referring to is a study done last year of online chats in economics forum, in one particular economics forum. And the list of, I think, the top 20 words when people referred to women was mortifying. I mean, it was... You know, it was very sexualized. I wish I could
like
pull up
breasts.
The list. It was breasts, hoe, suck, cunt. They just went on.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, well, fine, maybe, and it was overwhelmingly men doing this. Economics is a hegemonically male field. But women have to operate in this context in which the hostility, even if it's not overt, it's palpable. And so we see that in tech, we see it in sports, we see it in economics. And so the idea that these referees, that these umpires are just going to walk away because it's just unacceptable is just an example of how it works in these other fields.
And you talk about how this is something that, and we all do it, women mm-hmm. do it too, we ascribe different emotions and different reasons for behavior based on gender.
Yes.
And we do it from the time we're babies.
That's right.
That we look at babies and a male baby crying and a female baby crying, we ascribe different reasons to.
Yes.
And I want to get back to that, but it makes me think of, we go up to, now you're an adult, and you're Monica Lewinsky, and you have set a boundary.
Yes.
And
oh,
someone
yes.
violates this boundary, and you say, no.
I won't take this.
And what are the headlines, yeah. Soraya? Storms off.
Storms off.
Tantrum.
Tantrumy, childish. And she was very clear. She didn't mince her words. She wasn't rude. She just said, we agreed not to do this. I'm leaving.
Right.
And so,
she
yes.
storms off.
She storms off. And so I think that the thing that really interests me is, when people say, but men are treated, you know, men are called childish too, or there's no difference in the way people are treated, which is just frankly not true. We know, not only from our own experiences, in which we have knowledge, I mean, we actually know what happens, and that gets dismissed over and over again, but we have all these studies. And so one of the ones that was most recent was a study of courtroom dynamics, which is really foremost in my mind because it's so important, which is that if a male litigator in his closing statements, for example, uses anger, if he displays anger on behalf of his client, he's considered more credible, more authoritative, more trustworthy, a better lawyer even. But if his female peers do that, the opposite happens. They gain no power or authority from doing it. As a matter of fact, they're kind of distrusted for losing it that way. And they're doing the same thing. They're feeling the same emotions, and they're advocating in the same way on behalf of clients, but there's this radically different outcome.
And I think that's so interesting, because when you talk about rage and we talk about anger, which we have,
that's
in,
right.
in great store, but even before we get to that, it's not even about rage or anger. The way that women's behavior is looked at and assessed and the experience of it is so deeply policed.
Yes.
And it comes down to one. It comes down to a word that we've all, I think, as women, heard and encountered and wanted to smash things mm-hmm. over. You know what word I'm talking about?
I'm thinking ladylike, but what are you thinking of?
Smile.
Oh, my God, yes. Of
Smile.
Course. Actually, that is so funny, because I was talking to a friend about images of angry women, and I was like, well, all you really need is a picture of a woman smiling.
Right?
Like, let's just use a picture of a woman smiling, because how often is it the case that a woman is smiling because she's been so conditioned to put others at ease?
Right. And when you're walking down the street and you're not smiling enough, or you
oh,
don't,
yes,
you aren't pleasing enough, you are somehow not non-threatening,
yes.
and some stranger,
of course,
will helpfully give
suggest.
You his unsolicited command.
It is a command.
It is a command.
And if you don't do
you
it.
You will be followed.
Yeah.
And you will be yelled at.
And harassed. That's right.
Smile.
And smile. And that starts when we're little. I mean, little
right.
girls are encouraged to smile constantly. They're told that they're prettier if they're smiling, or that they should just be smiling because it's like the natural state of your face is supposed to be smiling. And I actually think there's a certain irony to this, because there are all these studies of male anger bias, meaning we attribute negative emotions to men, and we tend to associate anger with neutral masculinity, with a gender-neutral face if it's angry. So we have all of these predispositions. But in fact, it may come from the fact that men's resting faces are bitchy, okay? And we don't talk about that.
Right.
It's just that we call it resting bitchy face if it's a woman. We
right.
are not expecting men to look eternally dewy and happy.
Right.
Right,
like this. No, my kids, they know they have a thing that they call mom's angry smile. And they know that it's really about to go off.
Yeah, if you have that smile.
If I'm smiling, especially yeah. if it's with someone else, if it's like, I'm going to need to
I'm
talk.
Gonna need
I'm
going
to need to talk to somebody else now.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, she's going to
do it. Don't
she's going
to
kill somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, because, and why? It's because we've all learned to internalize that feeling.
That's right.
And that the angrier I get, the more I need to smile.
The more I need to smile. And it also, I think, goes hand in hand with that sort of, for some of us, an automatic feeling of crying.
Mm-hmm.
Because the anger itself can feel so transgressive that in order to to allay that concern or to say, okay, I'm being angry, but I'm not trying to take this masculine thing. We cry because it's vulnerable and it's feminine and we can't get the words out.
Right, and it's disarming.
It's totally disarming.
And the consequences of all of this play out so differently for all of us
yes.
as women, but for some women more than others.
That's right.
And that's really important to talk
it's
about.
It's really important
it's
to talk
really,
about.
Let's just get our intersectionality on here, because as you point out again and again, the consequences of being perceived as angry, of being perceived as difficult,
yes.
of feeling this anger and not being able to get it out,
right.
not being able to express it, have dire consequences for us in the workplace, certainly in our health, but much, much more for women of color.
And it starts in early childhood. I mean, I've written a lot about the boy crisis in education. And a lot of the arguments for that theory revolve around the idea that schools are very feminized spaces and boys can't be themselves and they need the rough and tumble and to be able to express themselves more aggressively or physically. And what's really interesting to me is that if you look at even starting in kindergarten, the children that are most penalized are black children, but black girls in particular are disciplined over and over again for behaviors that in, for example, maybe a more affluent white boy are considered leadership behaviors or just boys being boys. And we don't attribute leadership to girls who are physically aggressive or are assertive and confident. That becomes easily turned into mean girl behavior or bullying behavior if you're a girl and if you're a black girl in particular. And we see that it goes from kindergarten, where there's much higher rates of suspension and expulsion, and that goes straight through into a prison pipeline.
Right. And this affects us at all
stages. Yes.
And yes, and all stages of our lives. And you know, when we talk about where we are now in our culture and where we are with feminism, I feel like we are really reaching this moment where the transparency is becoming more and more apparent, where we're starting to really have these conversations
yeah.
where feminism looks very different depending
That's
on
right.
your race. It
yeah.
just is going
it's
to look different.
It's just going to be different.
And the consequences of your behavior are going to look different. And the consequences of taking a stand
are
and
going
the
to be
risks
very different.
Of taking a stand
yes.
are going to be different.
That's right. And I think that the hard part to me, certainly as a writer, I mean, I don't know if you had this experience as a writer, but for many years, if I used words like white supremacy, those words were taken out by editors. Editors challenged that. There were even pieces, I remember a piece I wrote for a national magazine where I had written this sentence, implicit bias studies in education show that STEM educators tend to end up, in effect, discriminating against girls and children of color. And then I explained why, and I cited these research studies. And the editor came back and said, this piece is a little long, we need to cut words. So I started cutting, and I inverted the sentence. And I just said, implicit bias studies show that educators favor young white boys, which is the exact same statement with the exact same studies and sources. And I got all this pushback from that. How do you know that? Why are you using this? Can you back this up? And I'm like, that's exactly the same thing. The research is the same. I just chose shorter, fewer words that describe this instead of that. And so what's happening now, I think, is people, maybe editors that otherwise were uncomfortable talking about some of these things, they're open to talking about gender and race, but still putting those two things together, which requires more work, different language, different frame of analysis, is very challenging for some people.
And you have said there's an anecdote in the book that I really love where you are on television mm-hmm. talking and you are talking about actual data.
Yes.
And the woman you were talking with says, I don't believe it.
No.
You're like, I have facts. Like, here are
actual
literal facts. Well, as we know.
But this is so interesting. What are facts? And what we're seeing right now is sort of a national exercise of identity protective cognition. When you see information that is a threat to your identity, to your status, to your worldview, instead of processing that information or considering the facts, you double down. That is really what's happening over and over and over again. So you know, you and I might write and we're like, well, there was this study and that study and look at this pattern and look at this history. And we spent a lot of time trying to do that. But in fact, that's not going to convince people.
And there's all kinds of data.
All kinds of data that supports that.
Like, we can show the data that says that the data doesn't matter,
that's
right?
That's right.
That you will not change someone's mind. And in fact, the more evidence you present,
yes,
the more other people will double down.
That's right. And they do double down. And what I find interesting, too, is an almost sure sign of that is a shift from considering systemic issues to the individual anecdote. Well, this isn't my experience, right? And it's hard not to say, well, in fact, your experience is not emblematic and might even be irrelevant given just the sheer numbers that we're looking at.
Well, we certainly see that. I think we've seen that repeatedly with what's happened over the past year in terms of the Me Too movement. Where, what do we get? We get, well, I never saw behavior.
Like, I didn't. He was always nice to me.
And from women. I worked
absolutely
with him. He didn't rape me on the job, so he can't possibly be a rapist.
Or even more pertinent right now, he's so nice in the carpool line.
He's
such a great dad.
And he knows women, and he's worked with women.
And he coaches women.
Right.
Yeah.
He actually has conversations with women. He couldn't possibly.
Not at all. Trotting out the class of high school students that he coaches had to be one of the most cynical things I've ever seen.
Right.
I mean, that was special.
But I want to know, how persuasive is that? Because you and I are looking at it like, you gotta be kidding. But
I think it's very persuasive for people who are inclined to be persuaded.
So what do we do about this? I want to, because when it seems like we live in a world where people don't change their minds, where people are on the defensive, and the more privileged people have, the more defensive they become.
Yes, the less empathetic and the more defensive they are.
Right, and there's all kinds of studies about that too.
Yes.
We could do about like the higher your income.
Yes, the less you care.
The less you give a crap about anybody else. So, what do we do? How do we? Because I do feel, maybe I'm crazy, Soraya, but I do feel some needles have moved in terms of these conversations that we're having.
I do. I think so, too.
So how do we keep moving it? How do we keep pushing our culture for both for men, women, and everybody in between so we can get to some place of respect?
So I actually am really hopeful from the perspective that I think young people, really young people, like between the ages of 0 and 20, are having much more sophisticated conversations about all of this.
You and I both have kids.
Yeah.
We know.
We know. They are living it every day. They are grappling with the difficulties of it. They are very conscious in ways that I don't think people who are certainly in their parents' generation generally are. They live in a much more diverse society, more diverse classrooms. And so I think that that's heartening. The biggest obstacles that I see in the education system actually come from the parents, from boards, from school boards, from moneyed people in private schools who, you know, they're going to penalize the school if the school pushes too much, if the school talks about diversity too much. I had a school respond to sort of one administrator's attempt to have a diversity day, which frankly is a bad sign, right? If you have to have a diversity day, then that means you're not having a diversity culture, right? What are the rest of the days, right? And the pushback from parents was that there's just too much talk about diversity. And I think that's pretty common in some places. The kids want to have the conversations. And so that, I think, is a positive sign. I admit that sometimes in despair, I think, walk away and just focus on 25 years from now. Just invest the time and effort and strategy and money in figuring out how to really effect cultural change in a progressive way. Because conservatives were super, super successful in doing that 30 years ago. You know, I mean, very systematic, very deep pockets, very clear agenda. And I don't think liberals and progressives, you know, we don't like institutions as a general rule. So doing that is harder, maybe.
And changes. Yeah, I interviewed a director once, and I said, you know, how do we make Hollywood more diverse, and she said, we wait for the old guys to die.
That's, you know, you're like, they're just going to have to age out.
Like,
because
we just
you
have to
wonder.
Wait to die, so, yeah. But there have to be some other things. In,
there have to
along
be other
way,
things.
That's because waiting around feels a little powerless. I have one more question I want to ask you,
yes.
Because this is, you talk so eloquently in this book about the real devastating, like literally will kill you effects,
yes.
that holding in our anger has, yes. upon us. And yet you also talk about the power of our rage. And you, in the last part of the book, you really address how we can channel,
yes.
the righteous fury,
yes.
that we are all feeling all the time.
All the time.
Right up
right
here,
under the surface.
Right up here,
yeah.
right? Like, just like, come at me, I'm, yeah. ready to go. To put that into positive action,
yes.
and to put this into community and to support for other people. I can't let you go without you giving me some of that.
Oh, well, thank you
for the chance to do it. Give me a little bit.
So I will say this. A lot of people respond to this book by saying, we don't need more anger in America. We don't need more rage. And
too late.
And I'm like, too late. Actually, the book is not saying, let's all get madder. The book is saying, there is rage. What is happening with this rage? And for so many of us, because it's not efficacious, it ends up hurting us. It hurts us, our bodies, it hurts our families, it hurts our relationships, it hurts workplaces, and it hurts our politics. And so at the end, I thought what we really are talking about is not anger management, which has its own kind of biases about what that means, but anger competence. How do we grow people who understand their emotions, who have authentic kind of relationships with themselves, so that the boys especially be able to express their emotions in nonviolent ways? And what do we do with it? And I personally think that there is joy and creativity and immense political power in understanding how to use it. And as you said, one way is to find your people. Anger can be super isolating. And if you find other people who share your values, who are moved by the same issues, then you shift the way that anger is felt and the way it is used. And so I advocate pretty strongly for that. The other thing, too, is because these penalties are real, it makes sense, particularly in the workplace or in politics, to find allies that can incur the risk, that can talk about the anger or what has to happen to change the catalyst for the anger without the penalties that you would. And honestly, that means that men have to step up to the plate. What amazed me last week was I saw an article about the number of women arrested protesting the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. And one of the articles, I think maybe it was in The Hill, talked about all these people arrested. And at the very end, it said, one man was arrested. And I'm like,
right,
one man? And to me, it's the same as all the emphasis that's being put on Senator Collins. I mean, yes, it would be nice if we knew that she would just reject this as out of hand. But in fact, where are the good men? Why are we sending her coat hangers? She got 3,000 coat hangers. Every single one of those men should be getting the 3,000 coat hangers. And so I think, again, it's that sort of double standard about women needing to be more virtuous or more responsible or more control of themselves.
Right. And the problems of the world it's just the classic, like, you know, asking for it, right? It's like,
yes.
it's like the responsibility,
the onus is yours. That's right.
Of fixing problems that we did not create,
yes.
Falls upon women. Soraya, thank you so
much
for coming.
So great to finally do this.
We're just going
to
keep talking.
We are. We're just going to go.
Like, this is it. This is just the public version. We're going to keep doing this for the rest of the
That's
afternoon, right.
right?
The book is called Rage
thank
Becomes
you.
Her, The Power of Women's Anger. I am so thrilled to recommend this book, Soraya.
Thank you
so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.